going to continue with the conceptual framework measurement. And we have Anne to give us a presentation. Please, George.
Thank you. Yes, Agenda Paper 3 looks at the measurement guidance that we're proposing in the conceptual framework exposure draft. We issued the exposure draft in May this year, and the comment deadline has been extended to the 25th of November, so you still have time to put in your comments. We await them. Await them eagerly. So at the moment, in the existing conceptual framework, there is really nothing useful on measurement, and yet it's a very important question that the board has to answer often. So in the exposure draft, we're trying to fill the gap, and the proposals in the exposure draft really set up two groups of measurement bases: historical cost and current value. And then under current value, we have a market participant view, which gives you fair value, or an entity-specific view, which would give you value and use for assets or fulfillment value for liabilities. And the exposure draft sets out the information that is provided by each of these measurement bases and the factors that we think need to be considered in choosing between them. So today, what we'd like is we'd like you to think about the guidance we're proposing in the exposure draft using the examples of assets and liabilities that we set out on page 8 of the paper. The first thing we want to do is we want to check that we've got a common starting point in understanding what information is provided by the measurement bases. So on pages 4 and 5 of the paper, we provide an extract from the ED which sets out the information that we think these measurement bases give. And then we'd like to think about the examples, what measurement basis you think would be most appropriate and why, and then we can try and see if the reasons that you have used in getting to your answer are consistent with the factors that we've identified in the exposure draft as being the sorts of things that the board should think about. So I guess the best place to start is first to look at the tables on pages 4 and 5 just to check that we have a common view on the sort of information that you get out of these measurement bases. I don't particularly want to spend very long on this. If you agree with the information that you think these measurement bases give, we can then move on to thinking about how you choose between them. But if there's something that you think we have missed out or incorrectly described, then that would be good to know. So we start with that.
It's a lot of information.
Yes, we provide lots.
What strikes me is that in many cases the current value, fair value, is equal to the value in use in the description. Many cases, it's the same.
That's true because we identify in both cases the sorts of information and the building blocks that you would use to arrive at those measures. The difference is that for fair value, you're always looking at the assumptions that a market participant would make, whereas for value in use, you're looking at the assumptions that the entity itself would make. And so the type of information you get out of the two measurement bases is essentially the same, but from a different perspective.
One quick question on the definition of historical cost measure. You talk about the recoverable cost of the unconsumed part of an asset as the historic cost. I guess I was just sort of thinking, well, some assets actually appreciate in value, so you've actually got a recoverable cost higher than the acquisition cost.
Yes.
And I just wasn't quite sure of the definition. If I was saying, well, the recoverable amount is more than the historical acquisition cost, that definition didn't seem to hang quite.
Right, what we're saying is that when you buy an asset, you've got its historical cost. As you go through its life, you use some of it up. That will be measured at the historical cost or the recoverable amount if it's lower. We have had comments back, and we did think while we were creating the definitions and the information you get, some people prefer to see it as you've got historical cost, and then you move to value in use, you move to a current value if that is lower than historical cost. But we wanted to set the system up so that impairment or an impaired amount was an integral part of the historical cost measurement basis. And so that's the way that we've done it, is to say that you look at the, you regard value in use as being the historical cost of the bit that hasn't yet been recovered. I think there is an issue about the asymmetry there, and the way we describe it, which we can try and address.
Why, the old fashioned is lower of cost or market for inventory. Market is not about, is not the, the market is presumed not to be an entity specific, but is presumed to be a current value. Why did you default to that one? Because that there is, because that, that tradition is there too.
Well, I suppose we would say that in terms of assessing what measurement basis you would use for any particular asset is something that we would want to decide at a standards level. The question of whether
I'm sorry, just to be clarified, within the historic
cost column,
why are, you know, what was the justification to defer here to one or to, because aren't you really sort of making the same decision again?
So the question is, why did we revert to value in use rather than fair value at that point? I don't know that we have a good answer for that. I think we were looking at what IAS 36, you know, currently sets up as our recoverable amount. But you're right, it could be, you could equally well set up the system so that you were looking at impairment through the eyes of a market participant, in which case you would come to the view that it's the lower of cost and market value, fair value.
So. That's the kind of question I have, is wouldn't the, if you did entity specific and there were transactions in the marketplace that implied that the asset was actually lower than what you assumed, then wouldn't you just take, would that sort of direct you to take an impairment, or could you ignore, you bought something at 10 times and you're trading them and it's trading at 3 times, you know, the asset allows to trade 3 times, would that?
We suddenly
inform you that, okay, well, yeah, we'll evaluate this.
What we would say at the moment under IAS 36 is that you could rely on your own assumptions and therefore not recognise an impairment. Now, we weren't trying to emulate in the conceptual framework what's in any particular standard. So the way that we've set it up here is I don't think we were being specific about market value or entity specific in terms of impairment. In current, what we have in current IFRS is, depending on the type of asset it is, you get different impairment tests, but the most broadly applicable in IAS 36 would say that you could use entity specific assumptions to justify a higher.
Although I think we would hope that if there was a fundamental difference between, like a huge difference between the market number and the management estimates, that the auditors would be asking a lot of questions.
Yes.
Just to prevent panic.
It's a difficult one because you could have a long-term asset that through a distressed, you know, someone makes a distressed sale that implies the value is a lot less, but actually, I mean, it's not.
Just to help out on that, remember that, because the term was used was fair value, not not current value, and the assumption of fair value is that there's no distress. Remember that fair value is willing, able market participants,
right.
And
okay.
You never get, so I used the term current to stop, to not get into the quagmire of the politics behind fair value. But one of the advantages of fair value is that it automatically assumes that they're willing. So the distress example takes it off. I actually didn't want to get, I apologize. It's just, we probably should figure out what the best measure is, and then what, if you are in the historic column and it isn't working, then maybe you can use whatever we've discussed today to figure out what would be the right answer if historic is wrong.
Yes.
And use that as an excuse to, in a way, move on.
I mean, one final point. We would expect it. I mean, if you did have very different market values apparent in the market, we would expect auditors to think about it. But part of the reason for the recoverable amount being set up as it is in IAS 36 is to stop people having to recognise impairments. Say, you know, the moment that you buy a car, you buy a new car, you drive it away from the forecourt, it becomes a second-hand car, and it's fair value, some people would argue, falls, but we wouldn't expect people to recognise an impairment on that asset immediately, because we think its use to the business is still the same. So there is definitely something about fair using entities assumptions to allow you something better than the market would indicate.
Could you argue that if the fair value actually, for one reason or another, is higher than the value in phone use, that you could still, you have two ways to use it. You can sell it or use it. Is fair value in use sounds like the higher of the two.
And in fact, recoverable amount
yeah,
under
IAS 36
is the higher of the two. It's the higher of what you could sell it for or what you could use it for. So you are always looking at the most you can get out of the asset, depending on the different ways of using it.
I just want to make sure that we were clear on that. What we were looking at here is what you get out of the measurement use, but then when you ask questions about the specific standards, they'll tell you which measurement to use today and how, you know, if it's a higher this or this. So right now the team is just asking you, you know, is this the information you need if it's measured this way? And then not asking you to get into specific standards yet. Meaning, you know, it's like you're asking, Mitch, if there's an impairment, what do we do? This is just saying, this is the measurement. If you got this measurement, that's what you get. Is that okay for you? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Is it an accurate description of the information you think you get from those approaches?
Yeah.
I mean, later on we'll say, well, if we say you're going to get this asset at this measurement, is that what you want? That's like the next step. Or not just Mitch, everyone.
In the middle column, I just want to ask you, the last item on the asset side, it's the same with the liabilities. Remeasurement caused by changes in estimates of cash flows. Isn't that kind of entity specific?
Well, it depends if you're in fair value or value in use or fulfillment value. If you're in fair value, the objective is to think about what estimates of cash flows would the market participants come up with. If you're in value and use, you think about your own estimates of future cash flows. So that's
I thought that the fair value column was like if the market participants are changing their view of future cash flow, that would be reflected in something else, like the price of a share or something. That the fair value column is something that we use, it's not something that we calculate. We just go on into the screen and read, it's the share price is 100, so obviously my shares are valued 100 times the number of shares.
Well, we say that you can have a fair value even if you can't observe exchange transactions in the market. So under IFRS 13, we have level one fair values.
Yeah.
Where you can see observable prices in the market, but we also have level two and level three fair values.
Yeah, but to me, the level two is similar to level one.
I want to time out because I think we should not get into every single table. I think we understand the three concepts of historical cost and the two concepts of current value. We should move on with the.
No, really. It's a minor detail.
Okay.
I know what I would answer anyway when we come to the
panel. Maybe when you come back.
Peter,
to
you're going to be the chair next. Careful. He's going to beat you up.
I think the table is quite important, though, because what we're saying is that there are factors the board's got to consider when it's making these measurement decisions. And the most important thing it's going to consider, really, is what kind of information is that measurement going to produce. So if it's going to make those decisions, we need to have a good... We need to make sure we've actually got the right description of what kind of information it's producing. Now, if you look at the cell that Peter was talking about, that could just be a change in the fair value if you just observed it directly in the market. If it was a level 3 fair value, you might have constructed it through the components. But even if you've just got a change in the share price, you might want to disaggregate that into some of these components that are identified here. This is sort of trying to identify what the drivers might be, and hence things that might be candidates for being reported separately. And it's trying to sort of say what kind of properties is that information going to have when it's supplied. And then the idea is that that will give the board a basis for deciding whether that's going to give you useful information. So I think it is important to make sure this table is correctly conveying what sort of information might be generated. And if we've missed anything or if we've sort of misdescribed anything, then I think it's important to find that out.
And to me, I thought that the third column was the column to look at when you have like value in use, when you have change in estimated cash flows. So I cannot really see why it's included also in the middle column, the fair value column.
Well, I think what we're saying is that the types of driver are basically very similar, with the exception that one's got a market participant focus and the other's got an entity focus. But they could be driven by the same kinds of thing. And so they're giving you similar types of information in a way.
So your confusion is around when we say fair value level 1, 2, 3, because 1
no,
will have...
One,
is that what
fair
you're
value
saying?
1 and 2, to me, is one thing.
Yes. Okay, that,
you
so
have
so
something that you trade on the market. Sometimes you cannot trade it directly, but it's so close to trading like a currency. So it's very solid, very reliable. And then you have all the others. When we are picking a DCF model, trying to calculate the value, to me, that is something completely different. And that's the level 3. And when I looked at this, I felt, okay, the right-hand side is the level 3, and the middle column is the 1 and 2. So that is how I viewed it.
It's true. He needs to understand the difference.
But for example, if you look at that cell, for example, in the middle and right-hand column, so one of the factors that could drive either of them is changing the price of risk. In one case, it might be changing the market price of risk, in the other, it might be the change in the entity's view of what risk is. Well, if the board wants to conclude in a particular case that a change in the price of risk isn't going to be relevant to the users, then it might not want to pick that measurement. Or if it thinks it's going to be relevant to have that information, then it might pick that measurement. So that's what we're trying to get in this table, is what kind of properties does the information have that's being generated by these measurements?
Properties.
So I now seem confused. Which means I was always confused but didn't realize it. I thought the difference between... I thought where the difference really could pop up between the middle column and the entity-specific was in the case not of things like the market perception of risk or difference in information, but because the entity had some other special advantage that meant that it could extract, realistically, we're talking about positive, so it could extract a lot more value out of it. And I thought that was the... Now, is that also on the reasons that you might want to... first of all, is that right? Would entity-specific value creation be on that list? And
yes, I think that is right, although... Okay. We do sometimes run into problems with units of account when we look at entity-specific and value in use calculations, because inevitably at looking at the entity's assumptions about cash flows, there are going to be synergies that it takes into account that might be regarded as goodwill rather than the asset you're looking at. Somehow value in use and entity-specific value almost inevitably incorporates some aspects of goodwill internally generated goodwill that a fair value might not, would not, because market participants wouldn't assume those same sorts of synergies. So that difference that you're describing, I think, would be a genuine difference between fair value and use. But also you could have different perspectives on risk and the price of risk. And it is, you know, it's a big question then for the board to decide which one it wants to specify as being, you know, which measurement basis is the appropriate measurement basis.
Sure.
And possibly to add to everybody's confusion, we can then, of course, customize our measurement basis. So you could choose perhaps value in use, but say that although we're going to go for entity-specific cash flows, we're going to say we want a market participant view of risk, because that can be perhaps seen to be more objective, more easily identifiable. So although we've set it up as two very clear distinct columns, I mean, Peter, coming back to what you were saying, if you're in a sort of discounted cash flow methodology, the distinction between fair value and use, you know, to some extent, that the ED suddenly leaves the opportunity open for the board to pick and choose a bit and say we'll have market participant assumptions for these things but entity-specific assumptions for these things.
We did leave it a bit open, but we also did have a sort of general proposition that mixing and matching too much might not be helpful.
That's true. We also said that we shouldn't create, you know, a different measurement basis every time we find a different
asset. You feel somewhat constrained.
That makes sense.
Okay.
Right, shall we move on? Move on to page 8. So, on page 8 we have a number of different assets and liabilities, and I would be very interested in hearing your views on which measurement basis you think gives the most useful information and why. So starting off with inventory, and here we mean, we're not talking about commodity brokers, we're talking about manufacturers who buy inventory, do something to it, and then sell it on. So views about what measurement basis would give the most useful information.
Anyone? Historical cost.
Same thing.
Why?
Same.
And why?
You would basically, if you would see that number change, you would expect that to be like a volume element, and not because of a price change. Because it's very unlikely that it's going to be sold. As you want to see the flow here, not so much change in value.
Would you feel the same if it was inventory that might be held for quite a long time?
Well, there's still, I mean, I still read this as historical cost, where if there is a huge thing in market price, it causes an impairment.
Yes.
I would expect the inventory to be impaired.
Yes.
But I see inventory as something that is ready for being used in the production process, and not something used for trading. And therefore, I would not want to see current value.
Does anybody have a difference?
Yeah.
Yeah, certain industries.
But with a quick proviso. For inventory, inventory when you purchase it is actually a fair value. So the question is your question was, so for most inventory, it's good, it's close enough to a fair value. The interesting one comes in, what happens if you hold it for a long period of time, and then it becomes more complicated. But I want to draw attention to a specific example. One of the companies I was aware of, they were making money on the change in plastic prices, not in the change of the toys they were making. So in fact, they would have actually, strangely enough, the only reason they could make money making toys is because they bought the plastic beforehand and they could have made more money by not making the toys and actually selling the plastic, but chose to stay in the business. And so if you were trying to analyze their financial statements, you'd have a real hard time understanding that there had been over a very short period of time a significant change. A significant part of what was happening was it was the change in value of their inventory that was keeping them afloat. Now that's an exceptional case, but certainly as the time lengthens, you may want to move on to one of the two other measures.
Peter.
We had one large mining company on the Stockholm Exchange called Boliden. That is the only company where I can see revaluations of inventory, but not revaluations, but impairments of inventory. And that is when the current price of like copper are lower than the historical cost in the company. But when the market is up, they don't disclose and no one asks for the reversal, so to speak. How much of the profit is because the copper price has increased over the quarter and so on. And when they report write-downs of inventory, constantly the profit is excluded from that when we talk about it, if it's substantial. If it's small amounts, no one cares. But if it is substantial, it is before inventory revaluation. So to me, it's not that analysts about covering Boliden are not interested in the price changes in the copper price or whatever. No. But we handle it in a different section of the analysis. We don't dig into the inventory valuation and kind of try to measure exactly how large part of profit is because the inventory in itself has increased. But we are looking at the total outcome and say, oh, because the copper price has increased by 18%, that must be a substantial part of the explanation. And on the other hand, also, Boliden also gives you a table exactly breaking down the profit development in the different components.
In that case, it's the copper is like a finished product, isn't it? That they sell the copper as it is,
yeah,
rather than take it and use it to,
yeah,
create something else.
Yeah.
So it's like a bit of inventory that's right at the end of,
yeah,
of any process.
So it's in a retail shop sort of thing.
Yeah.
Retail, they dig it up from here. So call it retail.
That's actually a segue into an analogy that I was going to make, is that, you know, in the case of retail, where you'll see if there's a decline in the value of the inventory, i.e. the finished good for sale, it'll show up in the gross profit margin, and there's a short period of time, and that's when you'll see the effect. So I think what you want to try to do is avoid too much volatility in something like that, because it's just confusing as an analyst to sort of figure out, what are we trying to do? We're trying to capture the economic reality of the company. If the t-shirts they sold that they want to sell are blue and everyone wants to buy red, don't mess about, managing the value of the inventory. It'll come through in the gross profit margin, economic reality of what you've done will come through and you're done. But that's that industry. Again, yeah, just avoid the volatility and from that side of it. But I don't know, when you know, automobiles are finished goods and the value of those, I'm trying to think outside of some of these industries, but broadly I think capture the economic reality, avoid volatility as much as possible unless it's absolutely essential, because it just gets confusing. And
the last time I came across this was back in the 80s when we had high inflation, and one of the models was that you needed to separate the profit into what was like an inflation gain on something compared to the value that you had added, and no one cared. And then inflation accounting was not introduced.
It's quick and material, flow through the gross profit margin.
Yeah.
And then you'll see what this affects.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Yes. So the next one is a building that you are using for yourself, whatever purpose your company does. So what would you think gives the most useful information?
Peter?
This I have come across on different occasions, and in particular when you have office space in a city. Very often this is discussed, if it is material, it is discussed separately. Like, in this company we have the ongoing cash flow and then they have the real estate. And sometimes we try to get the value of the market value of the real estate and put that on top of the other valuation, which becomes an error. But still, it is discussed. But the problem is that I don't think anyone really is interested in to have the balance sheet revalued. And you have this possibility today, and only one company actually do revalue property, plant and equipment constantly in the balance sheet out of 300 companies. No one else, leave out the property companies, of course. Mm-hmm. So to me, it's quite obvious that it is the historical cost, and definitely if we are talking about a production facility located outside or somewhere in the suburb or wherever, where the alternative use is not something that we discuss at the moment. But definitely buildings that a company owns can pop up. If you heard ABB, an engineering company, had back in the 90s, a property inside Tokyo, and all of a sudden, when that was at its peak, that was discussed a lot, and they were also penalized because they only presented that information in the annual report and not in the kind of fourth quarter report. And so it might pop up. But
how would you regard the change in fair value, for example, of current value? How would you, if that were in the P&L presented, you would probably take it out?
Yeah, but what the problem is that if you actually sell the property and you need the space, you need to rent it back. Mm. And unless the buyer is stupid, you need to pay a high rent instead. So you cannot only revalue it, you need to have some kind of current cost coming back onto the income statement.
But that's it. If you do a sale lease back transaction because you need the cash, it's a kind of financing, then fine. But I totally agree with you. Again,
you need a head office.
Yeah,
in the end.
Yeah, exactly. And that's not an important part of what's going to drive the valuation of securities that we have to.
Or it shouldn't.
But
okay.
I had a similar question when I was.
I'm
trying to take control again. I'm going to throw a monkey wrench in it. This is a conceptual conversation, and I think it should be at the current value. And there are a couple of reasons why I think it should be at the current value. One is people are talking about return on investment or return on equity, and if you've got a head office building in central Tokyo, and you know that is part of what you're. That is an asset, and your return on the asset is, you need to understand that. Even more so because it opens up financing opportunities, so the company now is actually under-levered because you don't have that asset there, or you don't have the full value of the asset. And oh, by the way, companies are constantly reevaluating whether they need that space. There are a lot of corporate examples where they sell the downtown space and move a little bit outside. So on a conceptual conversation for a building that is relatively easy to value, a skyscraper, the best answer is the current value, fair value. I think the board, just to be clear, I think the board in many cases can default back to historic on the argument of simplicity or added value. I think you have to have a second test, but from a theoretical point of view, it would be better for it to be fair value.
Locked. Can I challenge you? I understand, to some extent, but I think broadly speaking, when we are talking about some assets like inventory and PPE, which will be used to combine different elements together. And generally, maybe people feel, historical cost better
But of course, under some circumstances, you know, other value or measurement basis will provide additional information. It is understandable. So we just talk about, you know, normal imitation in cost, but for mining industry, maybe it is slightly different. This is why there's a huge debate over whether additional supplementary information is useful for mining industry. But in your case, you know, on the one hand, I understand what the information from the current value of the building it is. But on the other hand, think about the reallocation cost, which is part of the production process, and others. You have the old different kind of machines, you know, renovation of the buildings. You know, it is still different from financial instruments. You know, so you understand. I don't want to say information is not totally not useful, but when we think about a particular measure for a particular asset, we have to think about whether it will be used mixed with others versus it will be used totally independent. This is a huge difference.
So, if this question had been about property, plant, and equipment, I think the answer is a little more complicated, because then it becomes very difficult. It's not, even though by the way, I'm going to generally sound unfair about it. Nobody's going to be surprised at that one. But I think the conversation is much more complex for property, plant, and equipment, where when you're trying to evaluate it, you know, you ultimately have to value property, plant, and equipment as an in-use asset. And then it becomes much more complicated about whether you're using the company's assumption about, or the company's value in use to the market's value in use. On the case of the building, the building is much closer to, it's closer to a financial, a downtown skyscraper is much closer to a financial instrument. Incidentally, a lot of them are actually owned by financial companies, and a lot of large corporations actually rent them. And you should include sort of the opportunity cost of moving, and I agree with you that that would be worked into the valuation of that building. So you probably should include that. But I'll then also add, most companies reorganize their office space about every 3 to 5 years anyway. So it's, you know, whether they move between their building or their floors, it's some of this stuff gets disappeared. So it really is about the building is much closer to a financial asset than a plant, a mine, or a plant in some remote area that really has only value if you use it.
What I want to emphasize is I don't want to deny the usefulness of the information. And I also think, you know, under such circumstances as you described, in the management commentary, you know, company should describe, you know, what the market environment is, what the company intends to do, as you said, every 3 years, reallocate, and the possible benefit and consequence. But we're talking about the measurement basis for bookkeeping for the annual report purpose.
So, okay, thanks, that helps that. I started this conversation by saying conceptually, I think that was the right answer. I also said that, you know, the reality is most analysts, myself included, aren't really using, you know, that it's not that bad if it's historic, because there are other ways around it. But from a purely conceptual framework, I think most of these columns are going to turn out to be, and this is a, I think most of these are going to turn out to be the right, the most useful measure is going to be a variation on current. I just said it for inventory, I'm going to say it for buildings, and I'm going to go down this list.
Check, please.
Thank you. I had exactly the same view. When you have, I had, for instance, a company which I covered, which has a large plant in the suburb of Paris. So the price of the plant, the value of the plant might be a significant value of assets. But should they have moved, sell and move the plant, there would be huge restructuring costs, which are not in the value, then change all the supply chain for the groups that have been organized for 20 years, all the distribution channels. I mean, so where it is in very rare cases where the market value of this plant might be useful. So as I'm a car producer, as long as I am a car producer, I'm interested by the historical costs. Or I suddenly change my business. This is a different thing, I believe. That's why I believe you have to take into account exactly all the cost of the changes of use, which is very different then.
Okay. Mitch, please.
Just a couple things. I think it can only be historical cost. I mean, intellectually, I think you could argue it's fair value, but in practical terms, you don't buy a home office for, that's, you know, you don't, this is not to generate profits or cash flow. So calculating, you know, in terms of, you know, an accurate calculation of return on invested capital, I don't think it makes sense, you know, to revalue those purposes. Also, you know, let's not give the scope to companies to revalue their balance sheet so they can lever up on an asset that's really not going to generate any kind of cash flows on the back end. So you're effectively giving scope. You're effectively giving scope for a company to, you know, increase the risk on something that, you know, if they were going to monetize it, maybe in a situation that wasn't because they needed to. And to your point, I mean. In practical terms, it makes no sense in my view. It absolutely has to be spoken about.
Being recorded, I had a great rebuttal, but it's, I've been cut off.
Peter, please.
I raised my case. I'm on the same line.
Okay, I'll skip my opinion on this one.
Okay, an investment property then. So this is, not for your own use, but a property you hold just as an investment property. I presume the people who thought fair value before will stay thinking fair value.
Do the cost people
have
a different view?
I do.
Anyone?
Yeah, I'll say super value just to go for
number two.
Robert and,
I couldn't disagree with that. I mean, at the end of the day, you're going to monetize it, so on that case, basically, it makes sense to have an understanding of the value.
If I look at the property companies on the Stockholm Exchange, they all revalue the property. But if I look at the share prices compared to that revaluation, I cannot see any connection at all.
Yeah. Okay,
so I wonder. We agree. No, actually, I disagree. I'm very much in favor of other comprehensive income. So what I would like to do is to do my own valuation of the property company. That I really cannot do any longer because I don't have it.
Wow.
Well, if I...
you're a real
You met one.
So that is why I actually want them both. And I definitely don't see that the calculated value of equity, including fair value, so-called fair values, which is value in use kind of fair values on property actually has an impact on the share price. It's so interesting to see today, for example, how share prices in a real estate company can go up by 30% for no reason. Other than everybody's talking
about smart.
Yeah, the market is smart, and then it goes down again. And that happens all the time.
He's smarter.
No, I really don't see that the share price is connected to that fair value measurement that the companies do. And I have looked into this very carefully. So I really wonder if it's worth the work.
Yeah.
So you prefer
historical then? You want to do it
yourself?
Just list the names of the buildings and don't put anything on the balance sheet.
List the names of the buildings? I just want the figures that the buildings create.
What do you want on the primary financial...
What's the OCR?
I am in favor of using other comprehensive income. So I want.
What do you see on the balance sheet? That's
the fair value.
The fair value.
So I can do my own valuation, but on the same time, if they put in a lot of effort now, if they put in a lot of effort to do a valuation, so it's quite obvious that I can use it in some way. But obviously, it's not useful to valuing the share today, at least not in Sweden.
I think it's an IFS.
And does that answer your question?
It gives me lots of information.
I'm glad.
Okay, the next one. Equity investments, but there's no active market. So you hold shares in another company, but there's no active market. So.
It's not, you're not talking about equity like an associate, just holding shares. Okay.
I won't try to talk about investments in
just
associates.
Just a
shareholder.
Oh, we've got
you do not influence.
No.
Do not control, that's nothing like that.
You don't control,
just,
you have no significant influence.
Investor.
Just an investor.
Okay.
Right. So
who's let's start at Carlos.
I would go for value news, just because it's the asset is not producing any. And if you're talking about a plant, for example, that plant is producing profits. So based on the profits that the plant is producing, you can do your own measure of value. But if you have a participation, an equity stake into something that's not producing anything to you because it's not equity account, it doesn't generate any income.
Dividends.
Yes, but dividends are not profits, right?
Well,
they are not.
But it's cash flow.
Yes, but the value may be a multiple of the value based on the dividend.
Okay.
So evaluation of that asset, it's useful information.
I must admit, I hadn't expected anyone to say value.
That's why I'm here.
Okay, Mitch?
Just would go with fair value just for the same rationale with the investment property. I don't think that because something doesn't have a liquid or active market precludes one from being able to value that, whether it's DCF analysis or comparable trading comps, you can value just about anything. So I would go with fair value for the same rationale as investment property at some point. Could be expected to monetize it, and you need to see what the economic reality of that company reflects in order to value the company.
Yeah, Goro, please.
Yeah, sure. So I just want to clarify, this no active market means this is not listed company or?
Yes.
Well, it could be listed, but not frequently traded.
Yeah.
But anyway, I think that this should be fair value. As the reason we suggested. But if this is a kind of strategic investment, and if you do not sell, and if you are expecting some kind of synergy or strategic business relationship, etc., then it could be a history of cost.
Okay. Awesome, please. I think it should be at fair value on the balance sheet. Certainly, if it's not an active market, you have the valuation options of level one, level two, level three rather. So that should remain at fair value. The rationale being that if it's an equity investment, it's by definition, my expectation is that you're holding it to realize value when you sell it. But if you don't, I still think it should be at fair value of the balance sheet. It's just a question whether the fair value of the scope is a strategic investment for other reasons. Then there's an argument that fair value rules don't go through your net income, they should go through OCI. But the valuation, I don't see how you could use anything other than fair value.
Peter, if it is material, I don't think anyone would sell for share price traded once a week or something, if it is material. I think you need information. information to do your own valuation of the company, if it is material. If it is very small, then you can settle for a number that is roughly right because it doesn't impact your analysis. So it definitely boils down to whether it's material or not. We have in Sweden, we have investment companies with approximately 50% of the assets are in fully owned subsidiaries. They have the possibility today to do a market valuation, but no one does. And probably because the investors don't really want them to. They prefer to have the information from different subsidiaries and do the valuation themselves, because that is how they have done it the last decade or so. But definitely, if it is material and you don't have any active market, I would go for my own valuation.
Okay, thank
you. Yes, this is quite difficult to estimate what the fair value is all about in this equity instrument without any market value. So that I take the point with Peter. The question is, suppose you can measure the fair value, do you think it's fair to recognize in the profit or loss the difference of the fair value in the profit or loss? Do you assume that the difference of the change of the fair value should go to profit or loss?
I have a problem with that because earnings become very manageable just because of the change in
the assumption. Yeah, that's the point.
You almost need to grab to OCI to solve this because you don't want changes to become so manageable just because you have an unconsolidated tiny sub which then drives the primary financial statements. It's like the tail wagging the dog.
Yeah.
I think it's asking for trouble. Even though I can follow the logic that you would like to see fair value, but you don't want to see in the P&L to some extent until it's realized, maybe.
I think you need to run
this. Sorry. 5 minutes left. 5 minutes left, okay.
Forget maturity, as Peter mentioned. Forget the difficulties, as Taka mentioned. Forget OCR or not. Can I ask, or I think you pointed out very important conceptual issues, in front of us. In the ED, we say that when you judge which management basis you should use, you should base on the characteristics of asset and also based on the business activities, include business model. And in 9, financial instrument standards, we clearly say that you should judge from the characteristics of asset first. And then based on 9, immediately deny you for using the cost. And then if you already fail, fair value at all. And then next, if you not fail, then judge from the business model perspective. But you say that regardless the characteristics, purely from the business model point of view, we should choose from fair value or cost. It seems different from the board decision.
You are proposing two, the criteria. One is how the asset contribute to the cash flows. And then you have, characteristics of the assets and the characteristics of assets and liabilities. And one of the problems which I have for this proposal is that you are not distinguishing these two criteria, right? Which has more priority. So that is creating some confusion here. But I assume that this strategic investment type thing is contributing the cash flow, so that I prefer that piece to get cost rather than fair value. That was my assumption or judgment.
Okay. I think we are going to take a little bit more time to go through the additional lines because I think it's an important subject. And then we move on to the next topic on the agenda because we only have 3 minutes left and it's not enough for the other. But let's do continuous this discussion.
Okay, so the next one is a performance obligation arising from a contract with a customer. So this is where you've received some money from a customer and you need to do some work. They've paid you to do something and the performance obligation represents the cost of the work that you're going to do. So the question here, what measurement basis would you think would give the most useful information?
Robert, please.
I wanted to get my aim first because I'm not actually going to go for fair value. and the reason I'm not going to go for fair, and I'm going to introduce, I'm just going to use the strategy of real estate best use, the best use concept. What's going to happen is if you try to value these things on fair value, you're going to get a market cost to fulfill the obligations, when in fact the entity that would be best able to fill that obligation would be actually the company itself. And so by asking them to go, I'm thinking of completing a ship, something silly like that, it's always going to be more expensive for an outside participant to do it. And I think it'll be true even in things like insurance contracts and other places where you've got more information. And so I'll stop because Barbara will kill me if I do.
So, can I just check, you're going for fulfillment value there?
Well, I'm...
Just not historical, anything else?
I said value and use, but it's actually, that column is value and use fulfillment, yes.
Yeah.
Anyone, business opinion?
Historical cost.
Historical cost. Yes. There is no historical cost yet. Because you just...
Well, to be honest,
to me, I see a construction company.
Yeah. I think
the bidding, and the company gets advances from customers, and then all of a sudden it shows up that you will not be able to build a building with the amount of money that you have received, so you will end up with a loss and do an impairment.
Page 5. The definitions for historic cost measure and fulfillment value don't look to be, I'm not sure I understand the difference.
Fulfillment value is measured at up-to-date estimates. So, whereas historical cost is looking at the estimates that you would make at inception and then you don't update them. So,
So
fulfillment value is a current value measure.
So you're saying that the historic cost, if you think you're going to make future losses, you're not booking those as the historic cost measure?
No, because historical cost does include a liability adequacy test, just like for assets, you've got an impairment test.
So how is that going to differ from a fulfillment value estimate?
If it's favourable, you won't see it, only if it's unfavourable.
That's essentially right. But there is also the added complication actually in the performance obligation in that you've got the profit that you're making on the contract and how you recognise that over the life of the contract, which makes it quite a difficult one to consider because you could say that...
So this is basically per percentage of completion?
Well, I would describe this in terms of entry values and exit values, that you've got the historical cost is like the entry value, that the fulfillment value would be like an exit value, and the difference actually is the recognition of the profit over the contract. And I think we haven't spelled out clearly how in deciding what measurement basis you want, you also have to think about what profit recognition, what revenue recognition.
So it's
a bit of a difficult one to something
for.
I would move on to the next
one,
to be honest. I think we'll end up tying ourselves in knots.
Okay. Interest-bearing debt.
So it's just a plain vanilla bond? No,
yes,
no funny features?
No funny features. Just the normal.
It's your own debt.
This is really difficult because when I value a company, I normally try to separate the financial part from the operating part. And when I value the financial part, I would go for fair values or market value. Then again, switching back to the company presents an income statement each quarter and we react on the income statement and so on. I have this today in the real estate companies en masse. They have interest rate derivatives that are revalued constantly each quarter, creating massive gains and losses depending on the movement of the interest rate. And what we constantly need to do with the real estate company when they present that their earnings is to strip out that part of the financial net. So definitely I want the market value when I value the company, but I don't want the revaluations of the liability included in the profit and loss. So I would go for other comprehensive income.
So you like our own credit solution?
I like it.
So do you like our own credit solution where it's fair value on the balance sheet but the change in own credit goes through OCI?
Yeah, goes through OCI.
Okay. I'd like to flag on the own credit issue. I think it should definitely not be taken into account in putting it on the balance sheet.
Okay.
The own credit issue. So if your debt is traded at 70 on the dollar, on the euro, whatever. The claim on you as a corporate did not change. It's just that the value of that claim changed, but the claim did not change. So if you try to value the equity of that company, you should still work with the original claim, and you can argue whether you should adjust for changes in interest rates, but not the change in interest rate caused by own credit effects. I think those own credit effects should not be taken into account, because unless at the moment you actually manage to refinance and realize that own credit issue, that's the moment where you can say, hey, look it up, we really managed to refinance at 70, or you had a debt rearrangement, you can say we managed to reduce our liability and that is a gain. But until then, definitely it should not be taken into account.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
So you don't see information content and the sort of signalling effect you get from the change in your own credit? That it might be an early warning sign of things starting to go wrong?
Well, the sign is actually the opposite, because the sign that the primary financial statement gets is that the company is thriving, because equity is increasing and No, even if you put an OCI, the equity balloons because of your increase in because of the discount caused by own credit. So it's totally the wrong signal. The company is going broke and the equity balloons. How can that be possible?
Because the answer is because there's a liability that hasn't been captured in the current financial statements. Mm-hmm. But the signaling is quite clear the way they're doing it. So
I disagree.
Sorry?
Let's keep on track.
Yeah.
Because usually the first asset that has been impaired in the case you described is your own goodwill, which very fortunately you didn't record. So there may not be goodwill
at all. There may not be goodwill at all.
But you know,
internally generated.
Usually,
the he's agreeing with you.
Okay.
You had a good view.
Great, sure.
I wasn't clear.
Thank you. So definitely historical cost. Speaking with my financial institutions analyst hat on, we completely ignore fair value movements in own debt. We strip it out of our measure of capital because we don't think it's a real gain or a real loss.
so that it's lost the edit back, if it's a gain, we can deduct it. It is purely just accounting noise, and I think that's how we describe it in our criteria. That said, we have seen, obviously, banks who are slightly strong capital position able to buy back some of their debt. And that's the point, that the gain, or normally it's a gain when they buy it back, it will crystallise. That's absolutely fine. That becomes a real part of your capital position, and that should be accounted for. But this fair value option is not something that we think is a sensible option to allow.
Also, may I challenge that? Because
there's no time to.
How would you address payment in kind bonds where the interest is accruing? Because the original cost of that bond is 100, but it can accrue to 160. And the original cost
of
it
becomes 160, so you count it as.
It's historical cost. It's not taking account of the market value, so somebody might be willing to pay less for that bond because they don't think they're going to get interest, so you downplay it. But that's why I'm saying the historical cost.
It's exactly to your point. Your obligation becomes,
good. Mitch, please.
This can only be historical cost. Look, I think, Peter, to your point, we'll do the same thing. Absolutely, I want to look at the market value, the market cap, shall we say, of the debt to get a sense of what the, if you could refinance at that level, what the market really thinks the appropriate leverage should be on this business. Then I'll look at the market value of leverage, which is the par times the cash price. So if it's 60 cents, that's what the market thinks the appropriate leverage should be of the company. But at the end of the day, when you look at the, you look at the company, what's net leverage? Net leverage is the calculation of the full obligations minus the cash over EBITDA. The obligation doesn't change just because the market thinks it's 70. And what happens is we've also sometimes seen in strong markets where bonds are trading above call price or above par. Does that suddenly mean that the value goes above the par value? No. I mean, I think that here, we have to. It can only be historical, and the analyst will take that next step of saying, actual market cap leverage is this, but if you were to reduce it, then to your point, you're creating implied equity that's artificial. In other words, if you're saying that the difference between net leverage and market cap increases because the bonds trade out, you're implying that somehow the implied equity has gone up, which is in fact the opposite case. So, I mean, the answer is in the financial statements, there has to be a point where the departure is from the reality of the obligations, and what we do as analysts to make the adjustments. I think this can only be historical issue.
Okay, go on, please.
Okay, I completely share the view of Nathan, Osman, and Mitch. This should be the definitive historical cost. There are several reasons. First, that the reason why that credit on credit is deteriorated is probably that there should be unrealized losses on the assets, and this is not recognized. So why do we have to recognize on credit risk? That is one. And also that the signaling effect Sue mentioned. I think that this should not be accounted. Rather that it's enough for us that just to see that the bond price is falling. That's it. So that we do not need that the signaling effect on the financial statement.
You see that signal effect every day when we watch the bond.
But that's
if it's anonymous, I look at private companies all the time. The bonds are trading in front of me every day.
Bonds are
And lastly, I'm really concerned that paragraph 6.24 on page 11 on the conceptual framework. That this is exactly what requiring a company to recognize.
We are saying that the way we've defined fair value and the way we've defined fulfillment value would include the effect of your own credit risk. But we do go on to say that you might want to customize the measurement basis to exclude that effect. So if you look at suddenly on fulfillment value, paragraph 6.35b, we say, in practice, to provide the most useful information, fulfillment value may sometimes need to be customized. It may sometimes be appropriate to exclude the effect of non-performance risk.
So actually, I mean, let's make this explicit, maybe. Who would be in favor for the conceptual framework to explicitly state that effects of own credit should not be taken into account instead of
but
special?
Do we only talk about own credit? Because I was talking about the general fluctuation of the interest rate that creates, for example, in my real estate companies, a loss on a credit derivative. No way I can escape that. I will have to pay the loss.
But that's a different way.
No, that was what I was referring to. Now, I can also talk about own credit risk.
Yeah.
Because if I go further than Chuck, I would say the following. If you have a company with large debt, you normally also have a company with huge amount of goodwill. Now, if the risk in the company increases is because the goodwill and the subsidiaries that they have acquired are underperforming. Okay, so what we need to do is to take this gain on the bonds or whatever and match that not to a similar write-down of goodwill, but a larger write-down, because normally assets are larger than liabilities. We cannot, but wait. We cannot only look at the liability side when we are talking about risks. We also need to address the asset side. And that is the problem. We don't do it simultaneously. In the US banks, when they bought back bonds, they had huge amount of write-downs of credit losses. They had huge amount of credit losses. So in that respect, they actually ended up with a huge loss and some gain from buying back bonds that had declined. So I think we need to match the two. We cannot only talk about the liability side when we talk about an increase in risk in the company itself.
I disagree.
But also, I think it's a hard question to ask so bluntly, in the sense that I think if you're talking about a simple bond that's not held for trading, then I think most people would tend to say amortized cost is correct. You know? But if you get to structured debt instruments that have got derivative features in them, then the reality is entities will choose to measure them at current measurement because it's not as complicated as splitting them into different parts. And that's where it gets a little bit harder in terms of what you do with the current measurement and what bits should be picked up.
Changes in market value don't release you from the obligation.
Yeah.
That's the bottom line.
Yeah.
Changes in market value, as analysts, it's up to us to make the assessment of what the risk is based on the changes in market
value. And I don't disagree, so you don't get...
And I don't think you should touch the balance sheet.
But I just don't know if it's a good question just to ask so black and white, to have a CMAQ view that own credit should never be recognised, because I think that if we wanted to do that, we should have an analysis of the different scenarios, because we went a long way down the track, for example, in the context of IFRS 9, of whether we should do something to eliminate own credit altogether. So we looked at a situation where if you had a bond that needed to be measured at current measurement for some reason, because it was a very structured instrument, for example, we looked at whether we should remeasure it for changes in market interest rates, but not for changes in the entity's own credit risk. So you sort of remeasure for market rates, but not for the entity's own credit.
Liability purposes or asset?
Yeah, for liability purposes. I'm talking always on the liability side.
Okay.
And then we got into a problem that people were concerned that now we'd sort of made up a new measurement, and if you looked at this current measurement, you weren't really sure what was in, what was out. And it got a bit more complicated.
I think we should be in the business of disclosing and providing, but not in assessing and judging. It's like, oh, credit risk is rising. You know, that's for us to figure out.
Yeah.
Do you know, if I understood you correctly, in other words,
accounting might win.
Yeah, if I understood you correctly, that maybe I didn't. But
okay. Robert.
Just, I want to be very brief. I'm almost divided in this. I fully understand from a conceptual point of view why you want to measure own credit risk and why that needs to be impacted. So I have nothing wrong with, so your comment about you have to measure own risk and the fair value implications of it. But the problem I'm having with this particular, the example we've given right here is that it was a very simple example where it's the obligation hasn't changed. I actually think this conversation is turning around a measurement, a unit of account type problem. And the credit analyst in me says they're going to still pay $100. That's the liability. It doesn't change. So this is a much, we are the right group to talk to, but if you really want to get into this conversation, book 90 minutes and go through it. Because
I'd love to hear the view, but I think we'd want to do it with a more detailed analysis, was my only point.
Yeah, and I echo that. But the piece is the, what is often missed in the conceptual arguments for fair value is the dollar amount that gets paid doesn't change, and that's where this.
But what if you buy the company and start buying also the debt with the discount? You as a buyer, as an acquirer of the company, don't pay 100% of
the answer to that is it happened at GE, where somebody bought a whole bunch of preferred shares, changed the default rate of GE, and the share price, and he made a fortune, and the share price popped. So, you know, one of the problems I have with this is the moment you try and intervene and grab that discount, your economic situation has changed and you're back to the other one. And that's conceptually what we need to do this. I'd love to do this in a full session, 90 minutes.
Shall we reschedule a session on credit?
I think we should think about these issues step by step. Not mix different consideration altogether. Firstly, I agree with you, you know, if an ongoing concern, you know, environment, the set kind of instruments should be valued at historical cost. And the reason why on-credit issue come out is because NICE said, under some special circumstances, you are given options to fair value it. And the question is, you know, at the beginning, you know, whether you have to have the full fair value amount or the amount excluding the on-credit, as you said, you know. And then, as I remember, so whether I'm right, you know, we narrowed down the condition to use options in line. That is only if you want to reduce or eliminate, you know, mismatch. And then under such a conditions, do you want, you know, when you value the financial instruments, exclude on credit or not? Regardless how the amount changes should be put into OCI or not, is another story.
I think we need to address this in a more, because it's, we need more tangible documents to get through this. because I'm afraid that we're not going to solve this.
Okay.
Because,
A decommissioning liability. So if you have if you're obliged to make good some environmental damage because you've been mining or drilling an oil well, so what measurement basis would give you most useful information?
Okay, Peter.
Which one?
You
this
one?
Peter. Yeah.
I don't see Robert.
Can I speak?
Yes.
This is a tricky one because it includes the other ones. I don't think.
The others were so easy.
Yeah, it was a tricky one because it involves discounting.
Yes.
It's long-term. In some sense, like if you have a nuclear power plant or something.
Yes.
And what I want to see is the discounted amount with a fixed long-term interest rate that covers the total liability. So if it takes like 40 years from now, I want to have some kind of discounting with a kind of expected discount rate over 40 years.
I don't
want the interest rate to fluctuate. I don't want the interest rate to fluctuate, and consequently, I don't want the value to be dependent on the recent interest rate level. So I think what I'm aiming at is a discounted liability at some kind of historical cost, but I'm not sure what it's for.
Okay.
Would you say that though when you get close to maturity, so if you're now only 5 years from when you have to pay the costs, would you still want some historic rate at that point, or would you want to...
It is that short period. I would go for a five-year discount rate, but a fixed one of the time frame. I don't want, if the five-year bond rate goes up or down, I don't want the liability revalued that way.
He wants the locked-in discount.
Yeah, I want it locked in to a fixed discount rate over the liability time frame, so to speak.
Okay.
Robert, please.
So, again, not fair value. Two reasons, besides the obvious one about discounting could be different. There are two things that are going to happen with these things. First of all, there's the argument I gave previously, which is the institution or the company that's best prepared to clean up this is probably the mining company. The second one is the market will value, particularly things like environmental risks, they will take the most conservative view about how bad the problem is. So they're going to think the environmental cleanup is a lot worse. And so there's the additional dissymmetry of information that will happen in these type of examples. And so for that reason, again, the company's best guess is much better than going out and getting three companies to bid on the cost of taking off this environmental risk. They'll always pad it so much that from a user point of view, you're best off with the company's assumptions.
So fulfillment value.
Yes.
With a current discount rate or a historic discount rate?
I would take the current, consistent with sort of, I like current better.
Okay, we're done. Okay. Anyone else? Nobody dares to touch the commissioning liabilities? Thank you, Robert. Okay.
Thank you very much. I'd just like to sort of quickly wrap it up by saying that in the discussions you have, if you then look at paragraph 10, which lists the factors that we put into the exposure draft as being things that the board should think about, And I think that your discussions have picked up on just about all those factors. We've certainly been talking about the information that we produce and very much how assets and liabilities contribute to future cash flows. That was possibly the thing I think that came out the most. But you did also talk about, in some cases, the characteristics of the asset and liability, particularly in the when we started talking about credit risk, which was perhaps a bit of a diversion that we weren't fully properly prepared for. We talked about level of measurement uncertainty in terms of level three fair values and when that would change your minds about what measurement basis to use. Peter, you picked up about the linkage between assets and liabilities and how important that was to make sure that we don't create any accounting mismatches. We didn't talk so much about the final three, the enhancing qualitative characteristics. But that's, we are...
I think understandability probably came into it actually as well.
Yes, you think underlying, but understandability and not using too many different measurement bases and not creating new ones every time we thought of a new asset or liability. So from our point of view, I think that's quite reassuring that the things you think are important in choosing a measurement basis do seem to tie up with the factors that we have identified. So thank you. That was really helpful. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Just one
point.
Yeah.
As I said earlier, that the criteria B and C are, almost equal weighting. But it's a sheer fact that we only talk about characteristics. In some cases, as you mentioned, I think that probably
a B is more important criteria than C? That's my question.
It was certainly the one that I think you referred to explicitly most often, but I suspect there's a lot of the comments that you made in discussing things that the underlying all of them, the characteristics of the asset and liability were in your minds. But yeah. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.